Welcome to Bento Bureau.
Itadakimashita!
What?
Redo it again.
You idiot! Itadakimasu!
That was a joke! We always do jokes!
I don't want to do any more recording!
That was a bad joke.
Okay.
Welcome back to Bento Bureau, the show where we talk about Japan from an international perspective, with a side dish of socio-political discussion. With me today are my fellow team members, my international team members. Jess.
Hello, welcome back.
Bastion.
Hello, long time no see.
Hazel.
Hi, welcome back.
And Ichi.
Hi, everyone.
Pleasure to have you guys again.
Pleasure to have you too.
Today is the big 1-0. It's our 10th episode. Finally, we've reached 10 episodes after like 3 years. No, it actually hasn't been 3 years. It's actually been like a year. Let's get straight into it today. Today, to celebrate the 10th episode of Bento Bureau, we're kicking off with something special for you. After this short briefing, we'll have a new special guest joining our conversation. We'll be introducing him very shortly. The topic of discussion today: homelessness in Japan. So before we invite our guest, how about we just talk about that topic? What do we know about homelessness in Japan? Just some general facts. What do you guys know? We've all had some background knowledge on that through lessons or through individual work, whatever. So kick it off, guys.
Well, from my perspective, homelessness is definitely an issue here in Japan. However, when I walk through Tokyo, for example, I barely see homeless people. Only when I'm, for example, in Ueno.
That's true.
In Ueno, there's like this huge population of homelessness people. At least that's what I think. So I'm very curious about learning more about homelessness people.
Where did you see them?
I just saw them at the park, you know, laying on the bench or, I don't know, walking around with their bags of cans or whatsoever.
Mm. I think something really interesting about homelessness in Japan is, have you ever noticed that a lot of the homeless people here, they constructed their own homes and such. Like maybe they have something as small as like a box to maybe like an actual tent or canopy.
Actually,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. We learned about that in Japanese society, right? Mm-hmm. Where a lot of those people who end up being homeless actually have experience in construction work and industry. So they end up being very smart in their resources and building those kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, during my time in Fukuoka, so there's this huge park, and if you just walk around by yourself a little bit and go in the corners of the park, so there's no track whatsoever, you can see those, tents, or they have these huge sheets, basically, and they have like a tiny little house there. That's how it looks like. So.
But let's all be real. Like, when you see like an area filled with homeless people, what is like your instinctual thing to do? Like, what is on your mind? Would you actually try to pass through that area? Would you try to avoid it?
I would actually try to avoid this because, to be honest, as a girl, it's pretty scary to go into those area alone. Walking through people, like, sometimes I feel like they are trying to actually follow me. I actually had that issue once when I was in Tokyo and I was pretty terrified. And also because I don't speak much Japanese, so even if I want to help, there is nothing that I can do.
Where was that?
I remember it was in Ikebukuro. There was near the metropolitan buildings. There are like a lot of crossways, and so there's like under the bridge, and I sort of have to cross it. And they, like, just not just one, they're actually like a few people. They all have their own sort of like a tent, and they're just staying in there. And like, there was one man that I walked across him, and he actually went out of the tent, and I just almost running. I was like, I need to go.
Was that the night?
It was like late afternoon, like 6, 7 p.m.
What do you think about that, Ichi? What do you think about the topic in general?
The topic in general? Well, my only experience with the homeless people in Japan was when I was volunteering for the NGO called Second Harvest, where they basically collect like food surplus to stop food waste in Japan, and then they recook the food and distribute them to the homeless people. I have worked, volunteered for them in Uenosu, and we serve like 200 homeless people a day.
Really?
So, yeah. My impression is that they are, most of them are polite. They came here, come to collect the food. Some ask for extra for their, maybe their family back in their shelter or their own home.
Were there a lot of families who were homeless?
I am not sure about that. What can I tell you is that the vast majority of them are men. Most of them are the elderly. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, my only interaction with them is just when I was serving food. I did not like get to go back to like their place, or like talk with them after that. But I know that like the organization has to like distance themselves a bit from the actual zoo, because they have been complained that they are like, because they are setting their tents and distributing food over there, the homeless people might come a little bit too close for the place like the zoo.
And do you think there are many services like that in Japan?
The Second Harvest is the only one I know.
Interesting stuff. Well, looking forward to discussing this in more depth with our special guest later on. So right now we're going to take a quick break, and then afterwards you can join us for our discussion with Professor Tom Gill from Meiji Gakuin University. Stick around. And we're back! Thank you to our patient listeners. Joining us through Skype right now, Professor Tom Gill. Hey! Thank you, Professor.
Hi there, everybody.
So, we're very delighted to finally have you on, Professor. I think all of us in this room have come across your work in the past, be it through school or individual research. So, Professor, I'm sure we'd all love to know, just to get started and let the audience know, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to Japan?
Sure. Well, I'm 56 years old now, and I was born in 1960 in the UK. And I first came to Japan in 1983. At the time, like so many people, I was going to teach English in Japanese high school on what is now the JET program. In those days, they had different programs for different countries. Mine was called the BET program. I think it's British English teachers. We teachers were called bad bets. That was the great joke at the time. By chance, I got sent to the city of Kofu in Yamanashi Prefecture, where you can see Mount Fuji quite easily. That was my first 2 years in Japan. And at the time, I was quite casual about it. I had graduated from university in English literature. People who do that often don't know what they're going to do with their careers. And that was the case with me. I thought I'd just hang out in Japan for a year or two and then move on to some other interesting country. But somehow I got stuck, and 34 years later, I'm still basically living in Japan.
Wow.
Although at this particular moment, I'm in Oxford, UK on sabbatical. So anyway, after teaching for a couple of years, I got this job as a journalist working for Kyodo News, the Japanese news agency. And one day I got this article to edit about an incident in a district of Tokyo called Sanya, which I'd never heard of before, in which a Yakuza gangster had shot dead a leading figure in the local day laborer union. And until that moment, I'd never heard of Sanya. I didn't know they had day laborers in Japan or unions, or that there were sufficiently important issues between them and gangsters to involve people getting shot. It was just very, very different to what I knew about Japan before then, which was a comfortable middle class society without much social disharmony. All these images seem to be contradicted by this incident. So I immediately got interested. I went down to Sanya and to see what was going on. There were mass demonstrations every morning at about 4 or 5 o'clock with angry workers supported by radical students in helmets and bandanas waving baseball bats. And they were trying to beat up the local Yakuza. And several hundred heavily armored riot police were basically defending the Yakuza from the angry workers and students. And so there was a contradiction in Japanese society right there that I hadn't been aware of before. Mm. So to cut a very long story short, I wrote an 800-word article about that the next day. And 10 years later, I handed in a 100,000-word doctoral dissertation on basically the same subject. Sanya is an example of what is called a doyogai. Doyogai means a cheap flop house. It's the Japanese word yado, turned back to front. Yado, doya, a cheap flop house. And a doyogai is a district with a lot of cheap flop houses. And so during the course of my research, I gradually shifted away from Sanya to Kotobukicho, which is the Yokohama doyogai. They are two of Japan's three great doyogai. The other one is Kamigasaki in Osaka, which is the biggest of them all. And so for many, many years, I've been studying doyogai, which started off as day laboring markets. They had two basic functions. You have a cheap room for the night and a one-day job for the day, and you earn enough money with your job to pay for your doya room in the evening. Hmm. That was the day laboring lifestyle, and for about 100 years, it was an important part of the Japanese society and economy, because if everything goes wrong in your life, I'm talking about men here. You know, it was an almost exclusively male society. Let's say your marriage breaks down, you lose your job, you've got nowhere to go, you've got no money. Well, one thing you can still do is go to a doyogai. And with a bit of luck, you can get yourself some work for the day and a bed for the night. The economy just about works, and it's been a kind of safety net for troubled men in Japanese society for a long time. And what's happened during the 35 years or so that I've been studying doyogai is that they've gradually changed, because the demand for the traditional day labor on building sites and in the docks has greatly declined, and at the same time the population has aged, so that the average man in a doyogai is now about 60 years old, and they have a life expectancy of only about 65, which is about 10 years less than the average Japanese male. And so they've gradually turned into kind of giant welfare centers, and most of the men in Kotobukicho, Sanya, and Kamigasaki nowadays are not day laborers. They're welfare recipients. They're getting seikatsu hogo, livelihood protection, the basic Japanese form of welfare. Because of that trend, my own research gradually shifted from day laborers to homeless people, which I gather is what we're going to mainly talk about today. Mm-hmm. And so just finally, I'll mention that in the last 6 years since the terrible Tohoku disaster of March the 11th, 2011, I've also been doing a lot of research on victims of the Fukushima nuclear disaster. But that's a slightly different topic.
Mm. So considering how you distinguish day laborers from homeless people, would it be would it not be appropriate to say that day laborers are part of the homeless criteria in Japan?
Well, that depends on how you define the word homeless. You can define homeless very narrowly. The most narrow definition is somebody who is sleeping on the street or anywhere that is not supposed to be for human habitation. Mm-hmm. In Japan, on the street, typically around stations, public buildings, in underpasses, subterranean shopping malls, that kind of thing. Also on riverbanks, and sometimes in large public parks. Those are the three main areas where street homeless, well, they're broadly called street homeless, or in British English, rough sleepers. Mm. Now, according to that definition, Japan only has about 5,000 or 6,000 homeless people, and the number has been going down steadily since it peaked at about 23,000 in the year 2003. Now, on the other hand, some people use a much broader definition of homeless people, which is anybody who doesn't have a fixed abode or is cut off from family life. Mm. Detached from the great institutions of modern society, the family, the workplace, a steady job, and under that very broad definition, which is often favored by American sociologists, in addition to all the homeless people on the streets, riverbanks, and parks, you'd also have to add all the people who don't have a secure place to stay. And in that case, the day laborers living in their doya, their little three tatami mat room in Kotobuki or Sanya, would also be counted as homeless. Mm. Incidentally, most of these day laborers that I met would be very angry if you called them homeless. They say, I've got a job, I work on the building site, I've got a room in the doya. And to them, it would sound like discrimination to call them homeless.
So you're saying that it's kind of like a discrimination. I would like to know what the conception is of homeless people here in Japan then.
Their conception?
From the Japanese people. Exactly, yes.
I see. Well, I think that Japanese people, for a start, they don't think about homelessness that much in their everyday life, I think. But if they do, I think they too tend to have this narrow definition. That is the way people think about it in Japan. Hey, if you've got a roof over your head you've got enough to eat to keep body and soul together, where's the problem? That is the general Japanese view of it. Of course, the narrowly defined homeless are very easy to see. They're out there in the open, and people see them. And so they are the most, by far and away, the most striking kind of homelessness. People who are living in homeless shelters or in doya, indoors, they're out of sight, and therefore people don't think about them much.
So you're saying that the homeless people in Japan, they don't want to be thought of, like they don't want to be considered as homeless. To me, that is quite unique, because I don't feel like, for example, in Vietnam, that is actually a problem. So, is there anything else that is unique about the homeless population in Japan?
Well, for a start, it's overwhelmingly male. I mean, lots of surveys are carried out on the homeless population, and they mostly find that it's about 98, 99% male. Also, most homeless people are over the age of 50. I mean, it's not unknown for young people to become homeless, but it's rather rare. Mostly, they come from rural backgrounds. That's my own observation. It tends not to be included in public surveys. They tend to have a relatively low level of education. Of course, there are always exceptions.
So, Professor, we have read this article of you on the Asia-Pacific Journal, Failed Manhood on the Street of Urban Japan. In this article, you describe all this construction of the household of the homeless, which I feel is very unique, because our typical perception of the homeless people is that they just wander around in the street and just sleep in the street or under the overpass, while on here they actually created their own home. So what would be the reason behind this? It is because of their background as a day laborer, for example?
I think that is an important element, because a lot of the homeless men in Japan today used to be day laborers. Some of them still do some day laboring, and others are the kind of person who would have gone into a doyogai and become day laborers in the old days, but because of the decline of casual manual labor, they've been unable to do so. You know, people sometimes refer to doyogai as, in Japanese, one kushon, you know, one cushion. In other words, it's one cushion between losing your job and becoming homeless. And for many men, that cushion has now been pulled away, so they go directly from unemployment to homelessness.
I see. So I guess it's safe to say that homelessness is quite an interesting issue in Japan. How has the government approached the issue of homelessness?
Right. Well, for many years, the government of Japan essentially ignored the problem or claimed that it didn't exist. Theoretically, Japan shouldn't have a homeless problem, because Article 25 of the Japanese Constitution clearly states that all nationals have the right to a minimal standard of civilized living. We also have the Livelihood Protection Law passed, I believe, in 1951, which is designed to keep the promise in the Constitution and provide welfare payments to anybody who is unable to support themselves. And it doesn't say anything about how old you are, whether you're healthy or ill, or whether you're male or female or anything like that. It just says that anybody unable to provide for themselves should get livelihood protection. So that was the Japanese government's position until the late 1990s. And then it gradually became clear that whatever it might say in the Constitution or the law, the number of homeless people was increasing. And the government gradually started noticing. They started to carry out national surveys. And as I mentioned, those surveys sort of showed more and more homeless people every year until the year 2003, when the population peaked at about 25,000. And by the way, most people don't believe those government figures are accurate. The true figure might be twice as much. But probably, if they're making mistakes in their counting, they're probably making roughly the same mistakes each year. So we can probably believe in the trend, even if we don't believe the concrete numbers. But anyway, in the meantime, the government had passed the homeless autonomy support law, homeless Jiritsu Shienho. That was passed in 2002 and provided a lot of new measures to help homeless people, including the creation of a kind of network of public homeless shelters. Now, until this law was passed, Japan only had one public homeless shelter. That was in Yokohama, where I've done most of my field work, which tends to be a relatively progressive city on issues like that. But nowadays, there are something like 40 of these public homeless shelters dotted around the major cities of Japan. Mm. And so, of course, when you're talking about homeless population numbers, if you did it the American style, all those men and a few women who are in those public shelters would have to be added to the population on the streets. In American style parlance, they'd be called sheltered homeless as opposed to unsheltered homeless on the streets. Anyway, that system has generally done a pretty good job. The number of homeless people definitely has declined. It's declined to a level of about a quarter of its peak. And the homeless problem is now much less severe than it was before. So in this area, you could argue that Japan offers a kind of interesting model for other countries to consider following.
Interesting. Going back to the social aspect, you must have interviewed many homeless people throughout your research. For example, let's talk about the Doya guy. Is that how you say it?
Yep.
So let's talk about the Doya guy that you did research on in Yokohama. So I'm interested to know, throughout your interviews with those people, what are the most common reasons people cite for becoming day laborers?
Right. Well, usually it's a combination of two things, losing your job and your marriage breaking up. Mm. And quite often, those two things come together because a lot of Japanese women don't want to live with an unemployed man. And in many cases, there is already a strain in the marriage, and the loss of the job is the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back. Mm. So those are the two main ones. That's an interesting contrast with homeless people in America and Britain that I've also studied, where they're much more likely to be talking about personal problems like drugs, alcohol abuse, gambling, psychosis. In the American case, war veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, that kind of thing. So in a way, the Japanese picture is a lot more simple than in most countries, because that list of things I just mentioned doesn't apply so much in Japan. You don't have a lot of guys with a big drug problem, because for most people it's quite difficult to get hard drugs in Japan. And also, Japan has managed to stay out of major conflicts since World War II, so you don't have this army of severely depressed former soldiers, which is a big part of the American homeless population.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much. Since you touched upon already, I would just like to know, and I quote, you said a woman at risk of homelessness is far more likely than a man to be helped by the Japanese state. Why is that?
That's because of old-fashioned, sexist, patriarchal ideas which remain very strong in Japan even today. And in this particular case, the patriarchal ideas happen to work in favor of women. You see, from the point of view of your average social worker working in a welfare office in a Japanese city, the thought of a homeless woman is pretty shocking. And if she's got children, it's even more shocking. Mm. I mean, there are virtually no homeless children in Japan, although there are in other industrialized countries. And if they come across a case of a homeless woman, and especially with children, they will generally work very hard to make sure they find housing for that woman. On the other hand, if you're a homeless man, you know, the important distinction is that men are expected to be independent in Japanese society, and women are not. They're expected to depend upon their parents when they're children, and then on their husbands when they're adults, and on their children when they're old. That assumption of dependence for women and independence for men means that when a man comes along to the welfare office in a similar situation, they're much more likely to think, why is he unemployed? He doesn't look too ill to me. Why doesn't he get a job? Hasn't he been drinking too much? Hasn't he been gambling? And they're far more likely to instinctively blame the individual than to sympathize with their position. Having said that, I think that as the years have gone by, people have gradually got to realize that you can be a healthy male and still be in need of assistance. You have to remember that for many years, through the 60s, 70s, and early 80s, Japan had an unemployment rate between 1% and 2%, extremely low by international standards. So in those days, the idea that if you're a healthy male and you want a job, well, you can get a job. Mm. That was more or less true. Nowadays, of course, the unemployment rate has gone up and down a lot. I think it's somewhere in the region of 3.5% at the moment. Mm. It has been as high as even 5.5% at times. But anyway, with relatively higher rates of unemployment, of course, you have to rethink whether a fit and healthy man can automatically get a job. This isn't always so.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor. So you said that, say, a man were to walk into the welfare center of the city hall, and most of the people around that homeless person would instinctively blame the individual. That seems like one of the incentives to avoid using the welfare system of Japan. Are there any other reasons why certain homeless people tend to avoid this welfare?
One, of course, is pride. I have met homeless people who say they won't apply for welfare because they don't want to be a burden on the state. And that's especially true of guys who were day laborers for a long time. Some day laborers are very proud of their independence. Mm-hmm. They work hard, they don't cause any trouble for people, and they actually have a more free lifestyle than the sort of stereotypical salaryman who's being bossed around by his boss at work and then by his wife when he comes home at night. That's the image anyway. And so for someone who thinks like that, who still has a relatively positive view of the liberated day laboring lifestyle, it's very difficult to admit that actually you can't look after yourself you're going to have to ask the government for help. So there definitely are some guys like that. I think they are a minority, probably a fairly small minority of the whole. But in the old days, when the Japanese government claimed they didn't have a homeless problem, they often mentioned that. They said, you know, nobody needs to be homeless in Japan, but some guys just won't apply for help because of their pride. So that my position is there are people like that, but they're a relatively small minority. Mm. Another reason for not applying is you don't understand the system, you haven't had it explained to you properly, you are intimidated by having to face a lot of bureaucrats in suits and ties when you're wearing filthy clothes that you've been living in the street in for a while. Mm. And yet another reason is that some guys, one of the reasons why they're homeless is because of debt. They've got into debt and they've run away from their creditors. Mm-hmm. And when you apply for social welfare, you need to provide certain bureaucratic documents. Your koseki, your family register, mm-hmm. and your juminhyo, your certificate of residence. And once you have registered at your local city office and got these documents, it becomes easier for debt collectors to find you. And so some guys are waiting for the statute of limitations on their debts to run out. I believe I'm right in saying that if the creditor does not approach you for repayment for a period of 5 years, then the debt lapses. And so I've met quite a lot of guys who were sort of waiting for that 5 years to pass, and then they would probably apply for welfare after that. Quite a mosaic of factors at RIN.
Thank you, Professor. So I understand that there are individuals that become homeless, but has there any incident or event that affect Japan so bad that there are a large amount of people suddenly become homeless? I understand the economic bubble has some damages on Japan. So did that make the more people become homeless or even make the homeless population become worse?
Yes, well, of course, these sorts of macroeconomic factors do have an impact. The most famous early case would be the two oil shocks in the mid-1970s. Mm-hmm. That's caused a blip in unemployment and an increase in homeless people, took away a lot of jobs from the doyagai. And then the collapse of the bubble economy, as you mentioned, and then the 2008 Lehman shock and following global recession. All these things do show up in increased unemployment and homelessness. Although in the last 15 years, because of the new homeless self-reliance law and all the new shelters and support systems, that the homeless population hasn't actually shot up after the Lehman crisis, and only a little blip there. But while I'm on the subject, I should point out that this law originally had a statute of limitations that under which it would expire after 10 years. That was in 2012, at which point the government had to admit that they still hadn't solved the problem of homelessness, and it was extended for another 5 years. Mm. And that takes us to 2017, and I believe the law is due to expire in about June of this year. So it will be very interesting to see whether the government decides to extend the law again or allow it to lapse, in which case we could see a sharp decline in support for homeless people.
Interesting. Just going back to the social aspect again, I just want to just make the image more clear to me about what you witnessed during your research. So could you just tell us a little bit more about what you saw, about how they go about their daily lives, the day laborers? I'm interested to just know, like, what do they do throughout their days? Is it just them waking up from the Doya guys and trying to apply for labor the whole day and those protests going on? I just want a clear image of what you witnessed.
Right. You're not entirely clear on as to whether you're asking about homeless people or day laborers, which are two different things, and also which period you're talking about. Now, I mentioned those early morning street demonstrations. That was way back in February of 1986, I think. So that's, okay, what, 31 years ago. And nowadays, the average age of the men who live in Doya Gaya has got a lot older, and most of them are too old and tired to actually cause street riots or demonstrations. Okay, I'll answer your question in two parts. First of all, a typical day laborer's day, and then a typical homeless guy's day. Is that okay?
Yeah, sorry for the confusion about that.
That's all right. So a typical day laborer's day would be you get up at about 4 o'clock in the morning. You go out on the street corner. You look for a tehaishi. That means a recruiter, a street corner recruiter. Most of them are employed directly or indirectly by Yakuza. You try and get a job either on a building site or loading and unloading ships in the docks. It used to be there was a much wider range of industries where day laborers worked, but it gradually narrowed down until by the time I was doing my research in the mid-1990s, it was in Kotobukicho, it was nearly all building and dock work, and in Sanya and Kamigasaki, it was almost exclusively building work. And of course, the bubble. When the bubble economy burst in 1990, the construction industry was the worst hit industry in Japan because it was so overstaffed.
Yeah.
It employed something like 8 or 9% of the entire Japanese workforce, compared with about 2% for the construction industry in most industrialized countries. And so that's why the Doya Gaya were hit so hard, because, of course, the first person you lay off when the economy goes down is the day laborer. You don't have any responsibility or commitment to them. So anyway, your day would start very early looking for this tehaishi. And if you were lucky, you might find one, and he would give you a piece of paper with the details of the job and put you on a minibus to take you to a work site. It might be an hour or two away. It might be out in the country. You'd put in an 8-hour day of hard labor, and then you'd be back to the Doya Gaya in the minibus, and you'd then spend the evening very likely drinking, gambling, and spending the money that you'd earn during the day. That's an important part of day laborer ethos. Earn by the day, spend by the day. Easy come, easy go. Or the Japanese proverb is yoi goshi no kane o motanu, which means money isn't something that you keep overnight. However, if you still had some money left at the end of the day, then the following day you might take the day off. Indeed, if you think about it, at least in the 1990s when I was studying this most closely, you could earn about 10,000 yen a day for unskilled work. And nowadays it might be about 8,000 yen. You know, it's gradually drifted down. And the typical doya room costs about, in those days, you could still get one for less than 1,000 yen. Nowadays, I think the cheapest is about 1,300 yen, and they go up to about 2,500 yen. But anyway, if you think about it, assuming you don't have a wife or children and you don't have a home loan to worry about, you can actually do a day's work and make enough money for two or three nights in the doya plus your food and drinks, so long as you don't spend it all on far too much drink, as some people do. So anyway, if you're relatively careful, you could have a relatively easy lifestyle. Work one day, rest one day. That is a sort of day laboring tradition, one day on, one day off. During that time off, you might be drinking and gambling, or you might be reading books and bettering yourself. You know, I mean, there always were a few of these kind of intellectual day laborers. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but a couple of years ago, I published a book called Yokohama Street Life, which is about the life of one particular intellectual day laborer called Kimitsu Nishikawa. Very interesting street philosopher. I learned a lot from him, and I published that book with Lexington Press in 2015, Yokohama Street Life, The Precarious Career of a Japanese Day Laborer. It's also available in Japanese under the title Mainichi Aho Dance, Kotobukicho no Hiyatoi Tetsugakusha. The day laboring philosopher of Kotobukicho. So that was also part of that day laboring style, lifestyle, at least for some people. Check out that book. Sorry about the plug. So now onto the second half of the question, and about a homeless person's lifestyle. So this, of course, it varies greatly from individual to individual, but a lot of Japanese homeless people I found were living in sort of communities. I mentioned there are these three basic types: street, riverbank, and park. Now, the riverbank and park homeless guys tended to be in clusters of shacks and tents, homemade dwellings. They had their own sort of community, they might have a communal hut which they would use for meetings. In one case I came across in Osaka, like a little temple where they were commemorating a dead comrade with a photograph of him and candles and incense and so on. That's not something you often find in among homeless people in most countries, I think. Somebody would have to decide who got to live in these dwellings. And another interesting thing I found was that very often the guy living in this one of these shacks hadn't actually built it himself. Some other guy had built it and then they'd moved out. Maybe they'd got a job or they'd managed to get social welfare and this guy had inherited it. Someone in the community had decided it was okay for him to live there. So there was a sort of a kind of system there. And For example, I found this one very interesting riverside community in Osaka, on the Yodo River that goes between Nishinari Ward and Taisho Ward. Mm. And actually, it was a line of about 100 little huts along the side of the river. But some of them, I discovered, were actually empty. They were uninhabited, and they were locked. You know, these shacks had padlocks on them. And they kept the empty ones locked to stop the authorities from coming along and destroying them, because the authorities had this kind of mixed approach. If a guy was living in one of these shacks, they would generally leave him alone. But if one of the shacks became empty, they would destroy it, take it away, and try and stop anybody else from coming and living there. It was a kind of war of attrition, if you like, between the authorities and the homeless people. That was roughly the story in the parks and the riversides. Now, the government has had a sort of carrot and stick approach. At the same time that they introduced this new system of public homeless shelters, they also gradually cracked down on the park and riverside encampments, especially the parks, because of course ordinary people want to use the park, and you know, you would get complaints from parents saying that they didn't feel it was safe for their child to play in the park, when you have, you know, maybe 100 or a couple of hundred huts and tents with various homeless men in the same park. So they gradually cracked down. They set up temporary homeless shelters in the parks. People who were living in the park could go and have a proper room with a bed and meals and so on. But the other side of the deal was they had to abandon their hut and it would be taken down, and they would place guards to stop new people from coming and setting up new huts or tents there. And that has generally been a very effective system. And nowadays, you just don't find these big encampments in Japanese parks that you used to find. Mm. And they've been dwindling down to just a couple of relatively small holdouts. So that's okay if those guys are then going through the government mandated system, which they have these two kinds of shelter. First, you go into an emergency shelter, get you off the street or out of the park, with roof over your head, shave, bath, medical treatment if need be. And then after a couple of months, you're supposed to move on to another kind of shelter, which is called Jiritsu Shien Center, or Self-Reliance Support Center, where they will sort of help you apply for jobs, fill in your CV or resume, give you a suit and tie to go to interviews, and in some cases give you places on training courses to learn how to operate a forklift truck or drive a taxi or something like that. And eventually you leave homelessness and you rejoin mainstream society. And well, for some people that did happen. For a lot of people, however, it didn't, and they ended up dropping out of the system, because it's actually not that easy to take a guy who's been homeless for quite a few years and turn him into a regular working member of society. And when those guys did drop out, well, their old cozy communal groups of tents and huts in parks and riverbanks had in many cases gone, and so they ended up being street homeless instead, and a much less cozy form of homelessness, because of course if you're on the street you can't build a large shack, you just have a cardboard box, and you can't have any possessions. When you were in the park, you could have, for example, different clothes for summer and winter. If you're in a cardboard box, you just have to throw away any winter clothes when summer comes and hope you can get some more the next time because you've got nowhere to put them. And so for some people, things did actually get worse. So just to complete the story about the homeless daily life, a lot of the guys I met were making a basic sort of living by can recycling, collecting aluminum cans and taking them to these recycling centers that you have in Japanese cities where you could actually get cash for cans. On a smaller scale, people would do the same thing with cardboard, old newspapers and magazines. And so some of them would spend several hours collecting stuff for recycling, and then they used the money that they earned for food and drink, something like that.
Very, very fascinating, Professor. So we have so far talked about how the government have been cracking down on this homeless community. I wonder, with the upcoming Tokyo Olympic 2020, so far whenever the Olympic happen in any country, what they do is that they try to clean up the street. So would you say that with the Olympic coming up, the Japanese government will use more of this carrot and stick approach to get rid of these homeless, because all eyes are going to be on Japan?
I think that's almost certain to happen. So my first prediction is that they will extend the homeless self-reliance support law for another 5 years. That will take us through to 2022, when the Olympics are safely over. I think there will be stepped up efforts to get people off the street and into shelters and hopefully ultimately into accommodation. We can also expect to see a slight easing in the issuance of Seikatsu Hogo, livelihood protection, to get people off the street. So it should be quite a good time for homeless people if you're ready to go into the government system. On the other hand, it's going to be a very tough time for the sturdy minority who actually don't want that and want to continue their homeless lifestyle. Let me just give you a little local example. Recently, I went on the Wednesday patrol, which they do once a week in around Kotobuki, the Doyagai in Yokohama, to check on homeless people, see if any of them need help and so on. And they also count them. And the number of homeless people in central Yokohama, by which I mean the Kannai area, Motomachi, Chinatown, the baseball stadium, that area, was I think it was about 80 people. Of course, that's by no means the whole of Yokohama. Probably it would be two or three times that figure for the whole of Yokohama. Mm-hmm. However, in Kotobuki, there is Yokohama City's only municipal homeless shelter. It's called Hamakaze, which means beach breeze, kind of cozy. And it has places for about 250 homeless people. And on that day, this is a couple of months ago, they had about 120 people in, which meant that it was roughly half empty. And actually, the number of empty places in the homeless shelter was larger than the number of homeless people on the streets in central Yokohama. So you can see from that that it's actually not it's not a mathematical problem that there are more homeless people than there are places for them. Actually, in this particular local case, there were more places available than there were homeless people. So the problem is not providing more beds, it's providing a more sophisticated system that will appeal to more homeless people. You're going to ask me, how come these 80 homeless people weren't using 80 of those 120 open beds? One reason that comes up quite a lot is that the homeless shelters don't allow alcoholic beverages. You're not allowed to drink in the homeless shelter, and you're not allowed in if you're already in a drunk condition when you arrive. And of course, some of these homeless guys are also alcoholics, and so they can't handle that. So that's one reason. You know, in other countries, they've started using what they call wet shelters. You know, a dry shelter is a shelter that doesn't allow any drinking, and a wet shelter is one that does. And in other countries, they've started experimenting, you know, because of this problem that alcoholics just won't come in off the streets if they're not allowed to drink. They do allow a certain amount of drinking in these wet shelters. But as far as I know, Japan has no wet shelters. They have this rather stern insistence that you conform with mainstream morality.
Professor, could you give an example of a nation that helped successfully deal with this homeless issue, like perhaps other developed countries that have fewer percentage of homeless population compared to Japan?
Right. Well, I mean, America isn't it. America has a much, much, much higher homeless population than Japan, and all sorts of acute problems which make Japan's homeless problem look very small and simple by comparison. My own country, Britain, did do very well for some years. They had this thing called the Rough Sleepers Unit, which the government set up to try and get homeless people off the streets and into shelter. And for some years, the number of homeless people in Britain was officially given as just a few hundred, as opposed to a few thousand in Japan. But in the last few years, they've cut back on the budgets, closed quite a lot of shelters, and the number of homeless people in Britain is going up again. So right now, it's hard. I don't know if you could say that Britain has been more successful than Japan. I certainly think Japan is at the high end of the scale. If you look at how different countries in the world are getting on with their homeless problem. But just one little thing. The number of homeless people in Japan is smaller than in a lot of other countries. But those homeless people, I find, tend to be more isolated than those in other countries. Most Japanese homeless most of them are men. Most of them have no contact with their family, either their parental family or their marital family, if they've been married. They do not maintain any contact. They're basically hiding. They're living in secret. Whereas the homeless guys that I met in America and Britain, they often do, for example, telephone their mother at the weekend or something like that. Their families often know where they are, and sometimes try and help them. So the homelessness in Japan is a smaller phenomenon than in a lot of other countries, but in some ways you could argue it's more acute for those people who do become homeless.
I see. Thank you very much, Professor.
I actually have two questions, but since you brought up, I'm kind of curious, you asked that question in your text, so, and I quote again, how do homeless Japanese men position themselves? And I think you kind of touched upon that right now. Could you just elaborate on that again a little bit?
How homeless people position themselves vis-a-vis Japanese society?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Well, of course, it's difficult to generalize. Some of them do consider that their lives have been a failure. They're ashamed. That's, you know, shame, of course, is one reason for not getting in touch with your family. Well, to be honest, I think that's the biggest group. You know, others will blame society for their problems, but in my experience, Japanese homeless people are less likely to blame society for their own personal problems. They're more likely to blame themselves for it, I think. In some cases, they will blame foreigners for taking the jobs that they might otherwise have done. Mm. For the most part, I think that they tend to blame themselves. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Or were you looking for something else?
No, that answers the question. Thank you very much. And
you had one more question, so maybe this should be the final one, since we've already went past the 1 hour mark and you don't want to take too much time off the professor's hands. So
okay, sure. This is a relatively simple question. You already brought up the can collecting thing, and I think from my assumption is that a lot of people know that the stereotypical type how homeless people actually collect money is via collecting cans and then exchanging it for money. However, you also say that can collecting is kind of viewed as problematic. And that was kind of, for me, you know, a small curiosity I had, which was shocking. Why is it problematic?
Okay, well, on the one hand, you might think that people would approve of this because one thing we haven't talked about yet is begging. And one of the biggest differences between homeless people in Japan and in a lot of other countries is that they rarely beg. Mm-hmm. Actually, just in the last couple of months, I have been begged off by homeless men in Fukushima, Fukushima City, where I've been doing my other research. But it used to be very rare for Japanese men to beg. And rather than begging for money, they would try to make some money of their own by these various informal economy activities like can collecting, magazines, cardboard, etc., etc. And so on the face of it, that would seem like a good thing. They're showing their independence. They're not throwing themselves on the mercy of the general public. But the problem from the point of view of the authorities is that with these informal economy activities, it's difficult to make more than, well, maybe a couple of thousand yen a day, maybe 3,000 if you have a very good day. But generally, you're not going to sort of save money, put a deposit on an apartment, return to mainstream society with this amount of money. It's not enough to do that. On the other hand, it is enough to buy several cans of beer or shochu and get yourself good and drunk. And so the authorities tend to think that this is a way of earning money to sustain your bad habits rather than to get out of homelessness. Instead of being a rung on the ladder up to dependence, they view it as a sort of a step down because it enables you to carry on being drunk. And of course, alcoholism is among the difficult factors in homelessness.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up. Professor Gill, thank you so much for sharing your experiences and knowledge with us. It's been a pleasure. And as always, listeners, we'll definitely link some information about our special guest today, where you can find his works. He's got a series of free papers that you can access from the permission of him, of course. So thank you very much, Professor, for that.
Thank you.
And you can also find information on his books through our description, so definitely take a look at that. Thank you so much, Professor.
You're very welcome. And by the way, nobody needs my permission to download my papers. There's nothing I can do to stop it. You just go to you just go to academia.edu and help yourself.
All right. Thank you so much. And you can join us for our afterthoughts after this short break.
Hello everyone, and this is Long, your favorite audio guy. Since Bo is not with us at the moment, I shall take care of his part from this moment. Thank you for being with us so far, episode 10 of Bento Bureau with Professor Tom Gill. And we'll see you soon. Gochi so sama deshita, guys!
Gochi so sama deshita!
Thank you.